What was the most powerful technology introduced into schools in the past century? You might answer the computer or something like Zoom or even the slide projector. But scholar Antero Garcia argues that it was the humble yellow school bus. Buses have long been central to the struggle to desegregate education, and school buses are a zone, and mainly an unnoticed one, in which many working class children and children of color spend many hours of their days. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Each year, the iconic yellow public school bus carries 23.5 million kids to and from their elementary, middle school, or high schools, traveling well over 4.3 billion miles in doing so. While school buses were one of the most visible images during the desegregation of public schools, especially in places like Boston, where busing was violently opposed, the key role of the school bus in the lives of children mainly flies under the radar. Yet, according to Antero Garcia, it shouldn't. Garcia is associate professor in Stanford's Graduate School of Education, and he's author of All Through the Town, The School Bus as Educational Technology, which is published by the University of Minnesota Press. You argue, Antero, that the school bus is the longest lasting and most widely felt intervention in public schooling in the last century. How so?
The school bus essentially is as invisible as it is to society. It is the biggest form of technology that students encounter every single day. We usually think of technology as desktop computers in the 80s and 90s to laptop computers in the early 2000s to handheld devices like phones and tablets in this current context, and maybe to Zoom during the pandemic. But we tend to not think about old technology as technology. That might be the VCR that was in the room, or the television, or the slide projector. But the school bus, it might not be fancy, but it is the biggest technology in terms of the number of kids who use it every single day. Millions and millions use it throughout the U.S. And it takes students all across the country, right? It helps move kids. Our cities have been reshaped and our school districts have been reshaped by the way the school bus operates. I'll just say one other thing very briefly about this, and that the way I talk about technology with the school bus is in two different ways. One is the kind of big, ugly bus as a form of technology. It's loud, it's rattly, it's not very sexy, right? It's a kind of utilitarian form of technology that you might not love, but we can acknowledge is at least maybe a dated form of technology. And the other kind of technology is a social technology. And that is the idea of the bus and busing, and this idea of technology of moving kids from one part of a city or one part of a region to another part in order to shape the demographics and learning experiences that happen in schools. That's a different kind of technology, but these two are deeply intertwined, right? The formation of the school bus and the ways the school bus operates as a result of school desegregation post Brown versus Board have kind of moved forward together in history and in the public imagination around buses.
Right, and we will talk about that tale as it unfolds. But let me start by having you talk about when were the first school buses deployed in the United States and how did they become ubiquitous?
The first buses weren't actually buses, right? We can go back to before the automobile. We're talking way back now. Buses were essentially carriages dragged by livestock. And would take kids to kind of the utilitarian kind of our pastoral vision of the one-room schoolhouse, right? They would kind of collect kids on the way, take them to a single destination, take them back. And then really the way that we think of the bus today, there's this kind of clandestine meeting in the early 20th century where a bunch of men convened together and came up with rules for what the actual automobile version of the school bus would look like. This is where we got the kind of understanding of the bus as it is today. We would get kind of school bus chrome or school bus yellow became a national color that was unified across all buses in the United States. It's actually illegal for other vehicles in this country to be painted the same hue of yellow as the school bus, which made it iconic. It kind of created the kind of accordion-like benches that students sit in and made it so that seatbelts were not mandatory on most school buses. Most people who rode school buses did it without seatbelts, and kind of created the rules of the expectations of the driver. The driver needed particular kinds of classifications for driver's licenses, certain kinds of expectations of their cleanliness. This was a long time ago. And so we can think about the ways that rules around safety dictated the learning experience on the school bus, right? From the very early age, from the very early moments of the school bus, it's always been about safety and logistics, right? It's basically about moving kids from one place to another and doing so safely, which obviously is very important, but it means that we haven't thought necessarily about this as a pedagogical or a learning experience or a formative positive experience for the kids on the bus.
Before we get to segregation, how would you say did school buses transform public schooling in the era when segregation was established? Can we assess the degree to which the school bus was transformative in that period?
That's a good question. I don't assess it in the book, and I'm not sure. You know, I think at that point, the school bus really was, so pre-segregation, we're talking the early 1950s, the 40s, the 30s, right? Bus schooling was large. It was a segregated experience. It was not necessarily as fundamentally driven and as highly assessed as it is today. And we can think about the schooling experience as a place where kids from privilege were not using the school bus, and kids in more rural communities were essentially relying on the school bus to get them to and from school. I would say during those times, the school bus was less a mechanism for urban context and more about pulling kids from rural spaces and collecting them within singular buildings. The racial dynamics of this became much more pronounced post Brown v. Board.
Yes. Yeah, so can you remind us of how busing became so central to the efforts to desegregate American schools? In fact, busing becoming sort of a euphemism for desegregation?
Yeah, I think, so this is the euphemism, as you're mentioning, I think, is the way we tend to talk about busing without actually talking about desegregation. So post Brown versus Board, we have this ruling that schools must desegregate. Whether or not they have is a different kind of question in terms of what schools look like today, particularly in urban contexts. But this expectation that schools need to desegregate meant that suddenly we have this kind of logistical problem due to histories of white flight in urban communities in America. And so now you basically have kids who need to be moved from one part of a city to another. And rather than integrate schools by placing them in spaces that are cohabitated by many kinds of communities, that simply just doesn't exist in most parts of America. And so the school bus is the way that we quote unquote mix what happens in schooling contexts. And so you suddenly get kids who are doing long commutes in order to go to schools that might have a better educational opportunity. And largely this is how this conversation around desegregation and busing emerges, right? It's about learning opportunities and it's about educational opportunity and equity and equality. And while it means that everybody might be getting access to the same kinds of educational opportunity, or at least to the same schools, what happens within those schools is an entirely different issue, right? We can see the same kinds of histories of tracking means that schools themselves get segregated just at the school level rather than at the community level. But we basically get buses as the way that schools become much more diverse in terms of their demographics. This means, though, that this opportunity comes at the cost of students' time, right? That the kids who are being bused, and oftentimes these are working class, these are black and brown kids from around the country, are spending hours waking up early, coming home late in order to get to school that their oftentimes more affluent whiter peers are already at. And this is a case that continues today, right? As I'm talking to you from Stanford, there is a voluntary busing program that's been around for decades now that every day takes kids from the East Palo Alto area and takes them to more affluent areas around the Stanford community, the peninsula, for quote unquote better educational opportunity.
How did the way that busing ended up sort of standing in for efforts to desegregate public schools in America, how did that shape the enormous backlash that came against efforts to end segregation as manifested as efforts against busing?
It's a good question. I think the two become fused. You know, a lot of the literature around this is efforts to end busing are about efforts to end desegregation. We don't tend to talk about them together, and this is why I keep talking about this technology as invisible. We talk about busing, but most of this conversation doesn't actually talk about what happens on the bus. It's about the results of what happens once kids get off the bus, right? It's about what happens in schools. And so this is why the conversations around desegregation tend to focus on the impacts at the school, right? If I am a racist white parent, for example, I'm not, just to be very clear for the record, but if I am, I might want to attack busing and its impact on my child's education. And we can see those pieces. I'm not necessarily interested in what happens on that bus per se, right? You can go back and look, though. Occasionally, the bus emerges in some of the conversation around civil rights and around school desegregation. And you can think about the kinds of formative experiences that kids have on the bus, right? There's everything from bullying to romance to anger to confrontation with adult authority from the school bus driver. And you know, the ways that students spend hundreds, thousands of hours by the time they finish their schooling experience, sitting on the bus is a learning experience in and of itself, right? If you get on the bus every morning and you see other Black and brown individuals on the same bus with you, essentially commuting to their schooling experience back and forth, what's that tell you about the value of schooling education on you, right? These kinds of tacit experiences are the things that are less defined and less explored, and particularly in policy, it doesn't show up really there at all. But even in educational research, we tend to not talk about busing. We tend to talk about what happens to these kids once they're in classrooms.
Sure. And I should say I'm speaking with Antero Garcia. He's associate professor in Stanford's Graduate School of Education. We're discussing his book, All Through the Town, The School Bus as Educational Technology. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you started to touch on this, but I wonder if you could tell us who tends to ride school buses, and do we have any sense of how much of their day they're on the bus? Obviously, it varies, but any averages?
Yeah, that's a good question. So who rides the bus? I'll start with maybe this will seem like a catty response, but it's maybe the obvious response that we just need to think about. And that is kids, right? Kids ride the bus in a very big ratio, right? There's usually one adult to, you know, 30, 40, 50 kids on a bus at any given time. Most of the time that, and I'll say there's a field work part of this book where several of my grad students and I rode the school bus with kids as part of this work for parts of an academic school year before the pandemic stopped the bus and then stopped our field work on that bus. And so, you know, other than the times when we were on the bus as part of this work, it was really just the school bus driver with kids. I think what you're hoping to hear, and I do think, yes, most of the kids who ride buses are, at least in Californian context, tend to be Black, Latino, Asian. There are white kids who ride the bus, but it is not the majority of who ride school buses. And the reason is that kids ride school buses in order to get to school. Again, I'm going to spell out the very obvious things here.
Go ahead.
But these opportunities are essentially about, here in the Stanford context, the kids from East Palo Alto are given the voluntary opportunity. It's a voluntary transfer program. They're voluntarily chosen signing up in order to go from East Palo Alto to other areas within the peninsula. And as a result of that kind of voluntary choice, right, you can think of who are the demographics in East Palo Alto. It is largely Black and Latinx and Facebook employees. And of these individuals, Facebook employees don't tend to ride the school bus. They ride a different bus. That's actually something I want to talk about later. But of these individuals, right, the young people who are voluntarily signing up for this program, they get on the bus every morning. And to your question of how much time, the school bus that we rode picked kids up at 6:30 in the morning for school time that started at 8 every once in a while that bus would be late getting to school. So you can imagine it's about a 90-minute commute in the morning. It's about 90 minutes to 2 hours on the way home. And so you can think of, you know, three and a half hours of time spent on a bus 5 days a week. The bus that we were on took kindergartners to eighth graders to elementary and middle schools. That bus did not have a bathroom. That bus did prohibited kids eating food on the bus. These are for safety and cleanliness reasons. Again, safety comes first, not comfort. And so think about what's it do to a child's body, right? What's it do to a 5 or 6 or 7 year old to wake up earlier than their peers, maybe get some breakfast beforehand if they want to wake up even earlier, or not eat breakfast or eat breakfast once they get to school, not have access to a restroom, and then go learn for a bunch of time before basically doing the whole thing coming back, right, and sitting in traffic. That is a learning experience, right? And I just want to reflect on, you know, the students who live closer to these schools aren't waking up at 6 a.m. in order to get ready to ride a bus, right? And maybe you're doing enrichment or arts programs or Kumon or something else after school, right? What are the things that are missed out on as a result of the cost of educational opportunity?
How common do you think the Palo Alto voluntary busing is around the country?
It's one of those things that it's going to have different names everywhere. And this is the kind of hotly contested question of, does this work, right? And work has a different kind of answer depending on who you ask, right? For parents, for schools who are hoping to diversify their student body, this definitely works, right? Every day the diversity for these schools showed up right at 8 o'clock and then left right when school ended on the school bus, right? We can think of how this diversifies affluent school communities. And so in that ways it works, right? For the parents who are hoping their kids get a quote unquote better education, it works, right? For the kids, it works for something. I'm not quite sure what it is, right? And so we can kind of, I want to name that to think about like how common this is, because this is largely a thing that still operates across the country, right? Across the US. In every single state, there are school buses and they largely operate in this way. Some of the buses in probably more rural communities, and my research doesn't focus on this, but we can imagine buses in rural areas of Alaska are there to largely pick up kids in general, right? And it's not about school desegregation, right? It's just about getting kids to schools. But for the most part, this kind of program, like what I'm talking about in East Palo Alto, is anywhere where there are urban schooling communities. Busing tends to exist where there's kind of a large divide between working class and affluent communities. It is pretty common, and whether or not it works is something that we tend to debate. This is one of the few moments from the 2020 Democratic election cycle when Kamala Harris and Joe Biden were sparring to be the presidential candidate. We know how this ended, but during one of the first debates, this is where Harris kind of points to Biden and kind of points to the busing structures that his policy helped. And she talks about, you know, being someone from the East Bay, you know, she was one of the kids riding the school bus every day. I opened the book with this kind of vignette, this moment of exchange, because I think it's telling that it's one of the few moments where a politician reflects on what did the bus do, right? And think about what it means to be a brown body on a bus being transported as a part of what we don't think about as part of school. Even though I think once you ride that bus, you become, you know, the legal responsibility of school systems, and the responsibility from parent guardianship to legal school guardianship is transferred once you take a step on that school bus. We tend to not think about what happens in this kind of liminal moving space of the yellow school bus.
You argue in your book that unlike some technologies, although I could think of many technologies that are in this vein, the people who use it are not consulted about it to affect the experience. And I know that in your field work on riding school buses, that you talk to the kids about how they would make the experience of riding a school bus different. What did they come up with?
Turns out kids have a lot of strong opinions once you ask them what you would do to improve something. And so it was one of those things where I think if you just ask at the beginning, you get kind of rote responses. We spend a lot of time, my students and I, learning with these kids and trying to build up relationships. I think I'll just back up and say, you know, a large part of how I tend to do educational research is by focusing on whose voices tend to not be present at the academic table, right? And so I'm really interested in thinking about young people as experts, teachers as experts, community members. And so the school bus work really, as much as we've been talking about this from like the historical perspective, most of my work tends to be grounded in the, you know, what do young people see and experience and feel, particularly in the school bus context here. And so we started asking kids, and unsurprisingly, it's pretty traditional kinds of expectations of what kids want on the school bus. They want to be able to eat. They want to feel like they're cared for. They want to be able to have fun. They want to be able to rest. They want to be able to use a restroom if they can. Kind of basic. We think of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, like the very kind of basic things, right? Food and shelter and safety are the things that kids initially wanted. We started daydreaming other kinds of things later on. But I'll say the reason that I started, I didn't become a professor to ride school buses. I actually get motion sick, not necessarily the thing I was looking forward to. But the reason I was asked to engage with this work is there's a local superintendent who was introduced to me, knowing that my work tends to be about educational technology. I'd done work around mobile devices like cell phones when I was a classroom teacher in Los Angeles. And so kind of knowing this as a background, he, you know, I think he was really concerned about the well-being of these kids. It was like a really nice gesture of how he was thinking about these kids who he was the ward of for many years as a school principal at the time. And through our conversations, he explained that in trying to better those kids' experiences, he put a Wi-Fi hub on their school bus and gave them Chromebooks in order to give them something to do on the bus. It basically meant, though, in practice, most of the time the Wi-Fi actually didn't work, and sometimes a different bus would pick them up, so then it definitely didn't work because there wouldn't be one on it. It also meant that the kids were then just basically doing more school when their peers were not riding the school bus. These kids were then expected to do reading enrichment. And so while the intentions were good, right, this is, again, adults thinking of how they would improve the bus, it didn't match, I think, what kids wanted to do on the bus.
You mentioned the buses that, for people outside of the Bay Area, may not know about, but are ubiquitous, these very sleek buses that come into cities like San Francisco from all around for adults, for tech workers. You contrast that in the book to school buses. How do you think of the difference between the kind of buses that are made for generally well-paid technology workers and public school kids?
Yeah, so these buses, if you're listening to this anywhere in the Bay Area, they're kind of ubiquitous. You've definitely seen them. They're beautiful white buses. They're pretty strict about who gets on them, right? Because they're only for employees. And so they want to make sure that kind of proprietary work that happens on the buses isn't seen by the public. So I haven't been on one of these buses. I can imagine that, you know, they're lined in gold and there's masseuses everywhere for you, and lattes are handed to you as soon as you walk in. I can't say for sure, but I assume that's the case. But, you know, I'll start with the kind of experiential part of this. And that is every day the kids and I would be kind of sitting in traffic, getting to the 101 in order to get to the exit for where they're headed home. And as we're sitting in traffic, inevitably we would see these beautiful white buses go past us, somehow always going faster. I'm not sure how they get better traffic than we do, but you would always pass you, and you could see the kind of tinted windows and wonder what kinds of luxuries are afforded in them. And I say all this to say, it's kind of incredible that we talk about the yellow school bus, because there's no other bus that really looks or feels like it or sounds like it once you're inside it. Almost every other bus from, if you're riding a public bus, if you're riding a charter bus, if you are on Google or Facebook or an Apple bus, they all look and operate differently. And I think it's a useful reminder that because we talk about this because I talk about this as a technology, it's a technology that hasn't been fundamentally updated in a century at this point. And as a result of that, right, we can see that there's better ways to create better buses if we choose to invest in it. The problem is, if you say we need to invest X billion dollars in busing infrastructure, the conversation shifts to why are we going to spend money on school buses and not on schools or not on teachers or not on, you know, we can go down the list of other things, and buses don't become the priority because it's a tax that isn't paid by every single student who enters schools.
You reflect in All Through the Town on the design of school buses. Can you walk us through a bus and shine a light on the familiar for us. Why are they designed the way they are?
So I've got to say, I think most people think the yellow school bus is ugly. I think it's kind of beautiful, just how chromey and metal and kind of uncomfortable. Like, as a work of art, it's a nice looking piece of contemporary work. As an experience of riding the bus, it is less profound, I guess. And so you walk on, and no expense. I'd say whatever the opposite of no expense is spared is how the bus is operated, right? There's nothing adorning the walls. It is very kind of basic faux leather seats that, if you're wearing shorts like kids are in the summer, it kind of leaves those kind of those imprints on your legs afterwards. It's kind of big L-shaped benches that all kind of line up, and they're very tall in order for if there's a collision, it basically protects kids who aren't riding. Because you don't wear seatbelts, the bus is intended to kind of collapse so that the kids' bodies are obviously protected if they're not kind of moving their feet and legs into the aisle. There's a large mirror when you walk in at the top, so that the bus driver can basically see as best as she or he can every student riding the bus. There's a very loud intercom system, speaker system, so that the bus driver can speak to all of the kids, yell at the kids if they need to. We can think about the ways that control and surveillance are fundamental to how school buses operate. Many of them have GPS devices in them in case we need to know where a bus is located at any given time. But then maybe another thing that people might remember kind of nostalgically is I've never seen windows open quite the same way that school bus windows do. You kind of need two fingers to kind of push in and pull these latches down. It's a complicated hand gesture that maybe your own muscle memory will recall of how you open a school bus window, because no other window does it in the same way, I think. Maybe one last feature that I think is important to recognize is on the outside of the bus is the kind of blinking red stop sign. And you know that when that stop sign comes on, traffic from both directions must halt. And I just want to recognize the kind of power of the bus driver. Oftentimes in pop culture, the bus driver is made fun of, right? As like the person who is less than. They're not a teacher. This is just a lowly job of someone who brings kids to and from school. That's probably one of the most important jobs in America right now, as much as we don't treat it as such. It seems like a trend of how we treat public education. But the bus driver, when they push that sign, is the most powerful person in a city block, right? They're commanding the young people's bodies inside the bus, and they're commanding the traffic outside the bus at the same time. It's this kind of beautiful moment where the world stops at the command of this one person. The school bus has this kind of tremendous power, and because we see it so often, we take it for granted and tend to not think about it as such. But it's this utilitarian, bright object, and when you see it, at least in American context, you're conditioned to know what to do around it, what it's for, and how you're supposed to act when you see it.
Yes, your book focuses mainly on the experience of students who find themselves at the mercy of adults, both on school buses and at schools. But I did want to ask you a bit more about the drivers, who, without whom the technology of the school bus would just be a piece of metal that was, immobile. Bus drivers are some of the poorest paid workers in the public school system. And during COVID, the importance of the bus drivers became much more pronounced, especially when people got sick and all of a sudden people couldn't drive anyone around. How do you understand their role in the story of the school bus?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I don't dive into, and I don't know, if there's a period in American history where the bus driver was compensated in a better way. I doubt it, right? So I just want to acknowledge a part that I don't know the history of here. But during the time that we rode the school bus, so the academic year before COVID, and then when we were stopped as a result of the pandemic, we went through, four or five different drivers for these kids. And the students knew, oh, so-and-so's driving the bus, they're nice, right? Or so-and-so's driving the bus, they're not nice. They had to pull over, they went to the principal and gave so-and-so a referral, right? Like, they knew these were important relationships, and some of them, the kids really cared about them. One of the bus drivers actually knew some of the parents of the kids that they picked up because they had driven the bus for them many years ago. And so you think about this is an important role, and it's a role that, again, isn't valued by it's not valued in a lot of different ways. It's not valued financially. It's not valued by the schools, right? It's just a person with the minimal qualifications who's willing to do a job on a schedule that's not very inviting for most people. But it's one of the most fundamental relationships, right? Some of these bus drivers are going to spend more time with these kids than teachers, and definitely over more years than their teachers if we're going to pay them correctly, right? And so recognizing that, the challenge is teachers are expected to build powerful relationships with kids. The fundamental responsibility of the bus driver is the safety of kids. It's about getting kids from point A to point B. And as a result, building up those relationships with kids is secondary, and oftentimes they don't have time to do that work, right? Their eyes are supposed to be on the road and also occasionally on the kids on the bus. And so because you have this tension, what's actually supposed to happen, right? It's wild to think about the ways we tend to worry about the learning experience of kids everywhere except the school bus. And so as a result, the bus drivers aren't seen as educators, aren't seen as anything other than, people who maneuver cargo to some extent. I was talking with a friend about the school bus work as I was wrapping up the book, and she lives in Portland. As schools were kind of coming back in person, she said that every day she would drive her kids to school and regularly, right, to the school bus shortages you're talking about that were happening across the country, regularly she'd just see kids waiting outside for a school bus that would never show up because there was a shortage, right? Many kids were missing school because bus drivers had to find other work during the pandemic. It wasn't worth the compensation to come back. And when you think about, what's it mean? I think that the assumption that people might make from the way we've been talking about this is that I'm hoping for us to have a better bus, get one of those Facebook buses and put kids on it instead and put a bunch of adults on the bus. And that's the solution. And that is a solution. But I would say the solution, I just want to be really clear that the solution that we should be thinking about is this technology of busing, the social technology of busing and the school bus itself are largely American fixes to legacies of a historically racist, classist system of public education, and we could fix this by transforming what public schools look like. That might sound lofty, but it's no loftier than assuming that other kinds of technology, devices, ChatGPT, whatever the thing is that people are thinking about right now, are somehow going to revolutionize learning. School buses have revolutionized learning, but probably not for the kinds of powerful, positive examples that people might be hoping for.
Antero Garcia is my guest. He teaches at the Graduate School of Education at Stanford, and we're discussing All Through the Town, The School Bus as Educational Technology, which is published by the University of Minnesota Press. And at againstthegrain.org, you can find a link to that book. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, I want to ask you about the focus on technology as the answer to our woes. There's been a great deal of focus on technologies in schools, and especially digital technologies, which take up a large chunk of school budgets and are justified as being necessary to bring schools, quote, into the 21st century, whatever that actually means in the setting of education. And COVID brought many of these digital technologies into schools, and while remote learning is behind us, digital technologies have now been given a much greater foothold in the classroom. I want to just ask you about that, because you were just saying that we should be cautious of the idea that any technology can fix social problems. How do you understand that whole push to ever greater technologies, and especially digital technologies, in the classroom?
Yeah, it's complicated, right? Is that I feel like that's the most annoying professor response is, it's a little complicated. There's two sides to every coin. But I will say, I'm really, I leap at the opportunity to be critical of educational technology. I tend to be pretty grumpy about it. When I was a high school teacher in Los Angeles, I gave my students, as part of my doctoral work, I gave my students cell phones. And we basically worked with them together to kind of think about our learning opportunities. And there's some good that came out of that, but a lot of it really kind of reinforced the ways that adults can be particularly unkind in the ways that we treat and try to control young kids' bodies. I do want to say, though, before I get grumpy about technology in general and the ways the pandemic might have shifted our consciousness around this, There was a moment, I think a really powerful moment, where basically once the pandemic happened and we're no longer riding the bus with these kids, it meant that these kids were the obvious part of as researchers, we weren't riding the bus meant that kids weren't riding the bus, right? And what this means is for the kids who every morning were waking up at 6 in the morning to get to school with their peers, they no longer had to wake up at 6 in the morning. Suddenly, these kids got 3.5, 4 hours of their lives back. They were able to wake up at a normal time. They're able to, quote unquote, be off of school at a normal time, and were able to kind of get back to what schooling looked like. There's something of a reprieve during that period. It also meant for for these families that they were socially isolated from their peers, right? During this period, instead of continuing riding the bus, my graduate students and I and some other students started interviewing families of the kids who are riding buses to learn about what their experiences were in the opening months of COVID, to learn about that early period of what was happening. And for many of them, and we also interviewed kids from the same schools who weren't riding the bus to get some contrasting experiences. And so we'd get parents who, on the one hand, were worried because their kids weren't riding their horse as often. They weren't able to take horseback riding lessons from like a very affluent area, to kids who their parents were no longer able to work because of health concerns. They were laid off, or both parents were having to work, and then two or three kids were at home in the same room on different Zoom classrooms, right? We think about the chaos of what that period looked like, is everyone was trying to figure out what a quote unquote good learning opportunity meant and what a safe learning opportunity could mean. The good and bad of all of this meant that digital technology allowed schools to continue to function. Right now, our conversations tend to be around this idea of learning loss. How do we accelerate kids to get back to what they lost? But in my experience, kids learned a tremendous amount during this period, and it wasn't because of technology, right? I would say that the teaching experience might have been watered down for some kids. Some teachers did amazing work in quote unquote Zoom school for the greater part of 2 different academic school years, 3 different academic school years for some. But for the most part, the kinds of lessons that kids learned were about about the ways that they were valued and treated by school systems. And when we see an investment in technology, as we come back and we think about, who are we investing in? We're investing in the ed tech around us, the ed tech that's largely created on those white fleet of charter school but of charter non-school buses. What's it mean that we don't invest in the kids and we don't invest in school structures? Feels like the kind of question we should be raising right now.
Well, just to go further into that, you argue in All Through the Town, or you suggest that when we're thinking with technologies, obviously technology can play different roles in society depending on the way it's deployed. But you also argue that we should think about embracing analog tools rather than focusing primarily on digital ones. I wonder if you can first define what you mean by that and then tell us why.
Thanks for bringing that up. So I'll say it's funny. I'm talking to you staring at a typewriter. You can hear it clack next to me. Maybe as a brief anecdote, there's a period where during COVID, my wife got COVID, and so I was with I have 3.5-year-old twins, we're at home, just trying to figure out what to do with ourselves during this period, right? Everyone was a little run down, but we didn't have COVID yet, so we're trying to isolate. And at my wit's end, I pulled out my old typewriter, and my kids just kind of went to town on it. Just started like clacking on it, and they loved the technology. It was a loud racket. We created some, abstract poetry or something. I'm not quite sure what happened, but it reminded me of how much I love the kind of beauty of tech of analog technology and analog relationships. And I think so. What I mean by analog is the kinds of things that happen. That can't be powered or necessarily are not centered around algorithms or things that are blinking and flashing and transmitted through digital tools. It's a different kind of wireless learning, right? It's the wireless learning of two people being in contact with one another, or a person and a non-electronic device being in person with each other. A lot of this comes from my work. I studied tabletop role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons and thought about the ways we build community and play with one another without worrying about things like video games and just thinking about games. And I've done a lot of work around that space. And so I will say that, the school bus is a kind of interesting technology because I think the relationships that are fostered on them are analog relationships. It's the face-to-face building of relationships between kids. It's the face-to-face experiences that you get when you're sitting with a kid in a classroom. And some of that can happen over digital context, right? I think there are really powerful relationships that developed when kids were talking on Zoom with one another, but it's the analog work here. And so I think my key argument around all of this is that when we invest in digital technology, we tend to not invest in analog work that happens in schools and in classroom environments. And I think we should basically flip that on its heads. If what we care about as a civic society is the ways that kids are able to communicate with one another, learn from one another, see and understand one another, we need to focus on building spaces where adults and kids and hopefully typewriters are able to engage with one another in powerful spaces where they build up ways to dialogue, ways to communicate. And once we think about those contexts and those learning opportunities, then we can think about how the technology could scaffold and structure even stronger relationships from that. But we tend to foreground on the other hand, how do we surveil? How do we understand? How do we make sure that kids aren't cheating? How do we prepare kids for tests and use digital tools for that? And then worry about the relationships and the quote unquote soft skills second. And I think that's where this big tension between the analog and digital exists for me.
Let me ask you more about that, especially surveillance. You mentioned, well, kind of an analog form of surveillance on the school bus, right? The mirror. But obviously, digital technologies have allowed for all sorts of greater and more complicated ways of surveilling kids. Can you talk about that dimension of what the schooling experience has become for kids? And if you can think of ways that could be pushed back against? And to what degree does that surveillance, is it simply one of surveilling the kids themselves? And also, is there some aspect in which the teachers themselves are also being monitored in their work?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good question. I think, there's surveillance all the way down to some sense, or all the way up, maybe the way we kind of want to think about this. I'll say it doesn't have to be this way, and we'll talk about that in a second. I think, you know, the surveillance is, yes, there's a mirror so that there's always eyes on the kids. The kids also pointed to the kind of black box camera that is in this school bus and is in many school buses today. This is one of the few updates that has changed over time with the school bus, is that you get a recording device that records the kids on the bus in order for, if there was a fight, if there was some kind of altercation, that footage can be handed over to the school and they can decide if they need to hand over to the authorities, if there's something else to do. And, you know, every once in a while there's kind of viral work that happens around these kinds of closed camera devices. And so, you know, this kind of surveillance, it predates the kind of digital technologies, things like mirrors. You know, the panopticon is a kind of metaphor for how schooling operates. This has always happened before digital stuff, but the digital's made it even easier to do. And so you have kids who are surveilled, and as soon as they're on the school bus. But once you're in schools, you get the same kind of practices, right? Many schools today use kind of RFIDs on school ID cards, so that when kids swipe in and out, you know where kids are. And it's basically you track kids and their bodies throughout the school day. Teachers are supposed to measure student progress, so teachers are also surveilled throughout this process. This is all largely about safety, or is at least under the auspices of safety. It's also about kind of student funding by number of students in seats on any given school day. But I guess I should say, obviously, I care a lot about kids being safe, right? Obviously, I want that to be important. So none of this is to diminish those concerns. But we are in a state now where a state as a society where we are perpetually concerned about active shooters. We do something like an active shooter drill. This is not an experience I had when I was growing up, but is now a regular occurrence of how we expect kids to operate. Part of these concerns around safety and surveillance are because, as an American society, we've done this to ourselves, right? We can think about the ways where there are obviously hotly contested partisan politics that could shift this. But we could also think about what would it mean to build towards a more empathetic understanding that isn't focused on test scores, which is where much of the teacher surveillance comes from, and isn't concerned about forms of unfortunate kinds of violence that are happening that are preventable if we're willing as a society to shift, right? And I think this is where we need to think about, you know, if we're less interested in surveilling kids and teaching them a pedagogy of surveillance that constantly they're being watched in this country, and their identity is being questioned. What does that mean? I will just say that when I was a high school teacher, we had several lockdowns when I was a teacher. There was one lockdown that lasted for 6.5 hours. I was in a classroom. Kids needed to use the trash can as the toilet in this classroom. It was with 9th and 10th graders at the time. And the reason there was a lockdown was an adult reported that they saw a kid in a white, a Latino male in a white shirt brandishing a gun. That gun was never found. We don't know if that was actually the case, but the lockdown was so that police officers with gigantic guns could go classroom to classroom and basically profile every Latino male in a white shirt, right, one after another until they could find the kids and then bus them out to the local university parking lot where the parents would pick them up. This was a formative experience for the kids, right, to think about, you know, what's this mean for them to wear the most common form of clothing before the school went to school uniforms, which was boys wore white t-shirts. That was the kind of de facto uniform before there was an official one. And basically know that if you're wearing that outfit, right, you are seen as a potential danger to society, right? That is how you are being read. That was an important lesson for kids, right? They will not forget that day. As a teacher, I didn't forget that day. And so, you know, this is what surveillance looks like, I think. And this is the kind of implicit curriculum in American schools today.
Antero Garcia is my guest. We're talking about All Through the Town, the school bus as educational technology. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, to loop back then to the school bus, during this hour, you've been talking about the many complexities of the school bus, a stand-in for desegregation. You argue the essential technology in education in the last century in terms of the impact that the school bus had had on the lives of children in the U.S. I wanted to ask you what you would do to move away from the kinds of situations that the school bus is supposed to address and is not able to. I mean, someone might hear the conversation and think, is this an argument against busing? Is this, you know, given that children have what can often be an alienating experience of spending many hours of their day riding on this school bus, and these children are working class kids, kids of color, by and large. And so is this an argument for getting rid of the school bus? Now, clearly there are forces out there, many of them quite conservative, that would like to circumvent those sorts of solutions and have pushed things like charter schools as a way to say that people in poor communities should go to a different kind of school and not go elsewhere. And of course, those are private schools in effect with public funding. How would you make sense of the many threads here in terms of if this is the case, then what?
Yeah, so there's some pragmatic optimism here, right? And I would say, you know, the utopian vision of this is we don't need buses at all, right? And I think this is it's tricky because this kind of vision aligns with the conservative perspective of school choice, kids to be able to go to schools wherever they want. Largely that tends to be from a conservative point of view, they want to go back to segregated schools. They may not say it, but that's what those schools tend to look like. That is not what I'm advocating for. But I think there's an alignment of it'd be nice to not have school buses at all. In order to do that, we need a drastic restructuring of what U.S. schooling looks like. It needs to be schooling for all. But the entire foundations of what we assume school has to be and what it looks like probably need to be questioned, right? Do we need kind of, again, I'm going to deviate from the bus conversation, but do we need kids to be organized by grade level? Do we need classes to be organized around different kinds of subject areas? Are these the right subject areas for them to be organized around? Do we need to teach things like argumentation and debate? Do we need to kind of, the very fundamentals of schooling need to be rethought in order for us to then think about the place of the school bus. That's a conversation that probably isn't going to happen anytime soon. So let me back up and say, pragmatically, we should probably think about on the bus itself, how transformative it would be if we suddenly paid for three times the number of adults to be on buses and have kinds of mentoring or tutoring opportunities, right? To think about restructuring the actual bus itself and kind of retrofitting it, right? We have all of these incredible tech companies here in the Silicon Valley, Google and Facebook, and they are paying for their employees to ride these buses for free. I've been trying to get in contact with them and thinking about what would it mean to pilot using these kind of beautiful buses and see if the comfortability of the bus actually transforms the student experience or not. I'm skeptical, but I'd love to experiment with that. What would it mean to have better buses for kids? Some people have thought about this in terms of automation. That is a terrifying and awful idea to me.
Automation meaning self-driving buses?
Yeah, there's a company in San Francisco that I'm blanking on that was thinking about self-driving buses to reduce the workforce and to address the school bus shortage. But that seems like a terrible idea of like, well, if it's not working for adults, let's just put kids on the self-driving vehicles and see what happens. But I will say, if we're interested in relationships, right, as the fundamental part of what could happen in schools, I think a fundamental part of what we could do is think about how can we increase the number of people who ride buses, how can we compensate them, and transform what happens during the time that kids are on it. I spent a lot of time on planes as well as we're as the world is kind of coming back post-pandemic. And aside from not liking turbulence and you see the kind of nervousness around it, most adults seem pretty comfortable except for the physical that they're in very uncomfortable seats and seem pretty happy to plug in, watch bad TV, watch whatever their neighbor's watching on the screen ahead of them on an airplane, read books, get free snacks, right? You can think about how people enjoy the experience of flying, even in very uncomfortable situations, and even in like the arduous journey of going through security and throwing baggage up and like all of the like fun for the armrests, like all of those pieces, they still tend to be pretty happy being like nestled in their little corner, right? It's a reminder that the commuting part could be pretty good if we let ourselves imagine otherwise for young people.
Antero Garcia, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Antero Garcia teaches at the Graduate School of Education at Stanford University. His book, which you can find at againstthegrain.org, is All Through the Town: The School Bus as Educational Technology, and that's published by the University of Minnesota Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.